my mind was meandering. It meandered to a river, actually, which flows into the city of Ephesus in modern-day Turkey, called the Meandering River. It's where we get the word meander. And to the sacred river, to what this poem is drawing us toward. And the sacred river is a little like what I mentioned last week, which is the deep underworld river of truth. That's the word in Greek. Truth is an underground river, a female, a feminine river, a mother river. And out of her flows the nine muses, including music and poems. Those are the two best muses, in my opinion. But there are others. Even reason is a gift from the underworld, believe it or not. So, what a way to start. And what a question, what needs to be remembered? That's what I was turning over. What needs to be remembered? So, if you were here last week, I talked about the end of the world and apocalypse, meaning to reveal. And I was suggesting something like, yes, we are in fact living in the last days of Western dominance and the myth of progress. And I'm not saying I know what will happen in the future. I'm saying it's happening now. There is a kind of unraveling where the falcon cannot hear the falconer and the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. And something, some rough beast come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem waiting to be born. These are the lines of Yeats written in 1919, something like that, after the First World War. And he's drinking from the same river that Kublai Khan was born from. So I want to hover around some things today and ask some questions. And I guess I'd like to start by asking questions around how, not so much questions around what. Like, one approach is, well, what is happening? And another approach that's related is, how did we get here? And those are worthy, but I'm a little more interested in, well, how shall we live, or what ways of being are most called for in times like these, in apocalyptic times. And I might just offer a suggestion from the natural world, and we are the natural world. The fact that we call it the natural world is funny. Like, oh, that the other place. And that is that life wants to be, you know. Lichen wants to be. It's not trying to be something else, but it will be what it will be as long as its being is being. And that we might call eros or vitality or truth that life wants to be. And I'd like to start by saying that here we are and life wants to be. And as conscious beings, and I would like to add, maybe you would agree, human beings are somewhat conscious, we would say. We've probably fallen in love with what we call consciousness and like Icarus and flown too close to the sun, because not only is there such a thing called the unconscious, but we're not all that conscious when we're conscious. And we still have to wrestle with, well, how shall we be? How shall we live? And the first kind of thing I want to just hover around for a moment is that line from Yeats from last week, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And I really would like you to watch the news this week and let that roll around in your head. And do not separate yourself out of it by saying those people on the other side are the ones that are full of passionate intensity, as you're saying that with passionate intensity. Just let it work you a bit and say, is this true? Well, it's definitely true on the news, because the news is run by advertisements, and advertisements run on the great primal passions like fear and lust and greed. And that's what's running our news cycle. And those that are the most powerful advertisers right now are the pharmaceutical companies. How do you know that? Because every single freaking commercial is a pharmaceutical commercial. Because they have all the answers for everything, of course. Anyway, I'm already on a tangent. But it means that our news cycle is attracted to passionate intensity. That's all that sells. And the best lack all conviction. And it ends up polarizing everything. Marketing and news and social media. It pushes out toward those extremes. And I'm just saying, let that quotation roll around and ask yourself, well, where are the best of us that lack all conviction? So here's a question coming out of this. What do we gain by feeding this kind of polarization? What do we gain? Because it's been going on for a while now, the kind of polarization that's happening. What do we gain from it? What do we lose from it? I'm not going to answer these questions. I'm just saying, what do we gain from it? What do we lose from it? Here's another question. What is gained by thinking the worst of other people? What's gained in that? It's fun. I mean, personally, it's fun. Like, I kind of revel in it. But what's really gained by thinking the worst of someone else? You could say the opposite to what is gained by always assuming the best. Or maybe it's somewhere in between, I don't know. Where is it possible to not be naive and still think, generally speaking, the best of someone else? I'm not suggesting you go one way or the other, but just to wrestle with what is gained by thinking the worst, being pulled out to the extremes where the worst are full of passionate intensity. Here's another question. I'd like to do a whole talk on this sometime. Is it time to think beyond red and blue? I think most of us would probably say, yeah, it's time to do that, but maybe we can flip the state. One way or the other. I'm asking the question because it has to do with the same polarization. What is gained by continuing to play just that game? Just the game of red and blue. That's all we're going to play. Because it's the only one that matters. We don't have time to think about anything else. I don't know if you, what's her name? Barry Weiss, used to be a writer for the New York Times, quit under some unusual circumstances. And she has a podcast, and she was interviewing Andrew Yang. He started a new party. You're familiar with this? I found the interview very fascinating. You should look it up and listen to it yourself. But he was basically saying, and he's he's much more optimistic than I am about the world. But he started a new party. And of course, the advice from everyone is, you can't do that. Because the only game in town is red and blue. And if you suck energy somewhere else, you suck energy away from the game that everyone's playing. But hardly anyone is saying, what if we played a different game? What is gained by continuing to play the two-pole game? And here's a question that is behind that in my mind. What is the relationship between our common humanity? That's one of the values that we say we have here at C3. Common humanity. So what is the relationship between our common humanity and our differences? That seems to be the ground, the terrain that is worth wandering around in. What's the relationship between the two? And of course, what's being lost or emphasized when we're only concerned about just our differences? Okay. Now, I want to ask this question and not intend to answer it, but I will first ask it. I am going somewhere, by the way. Why are we here? There are various ways one can answer this question. And I'll just give you two. that seem interesting to me at the moment. One is rooted in the scientific enlightenment, and that's the path of how we got here scientifically. How do we get here? Well, 14.5 billion years ago, something started or imploded, and then we could never stop talking about that, correct? How did any of us get here? And I think that's a valuable exercise. Why not? Why not ask that kind of question? Religion or religions or spirituality does ask the same question. Why are we here? It just doesn't start in the same place. And it's something like, we're created to be here. And then depending on your various religion or perspective, then you have some responsibility or something like that. Some form of responsibility is given. If we're created, we're obligated to the Creator, for example, to live in a certain way. And it kind of results in two ways of looking at the world that are prevalent right now. And I'll just borrow a line from David White that I read a couple weeks ago. Here's his line. You are not an accident amidst other accidents. You are not an accident amidst other accidents. Now, honestly, we'll do the old-fashioned, like we're in a classroom. How many want this to be true? The rest of you, that you don't care? You're like, pfft. Okay, you are not an accident. But part of what we're having to wrestle with, almost for the first time, is the opposite of that. You're an accident among accidents. And I am not suggesting that that tension really needs to be resolved right now. I tend to fall on the side of David White, but there's also something powerful in saying, we don't know how the world works. We don't know why particles collide into each other. We can't. It's hard to follow, to go down that trail and see how any of us got here. I'm going to read some more Bill Bryson in a second, just to make things fun. So I'm just saying there's a kind of tension present. So this leads me to the point of today's talk. And it's a question, really. Is life a gift? That's what I want us to be wrestling with. That's what Thanksgiving is supposed to confront us with. Forget about all the other crap. Just the, is life a gift or not? Or is anything in my life a gift or not? If you want to go that route. What is our, how does our relationship with whatever the beingness of our being is doing when we approach it as a kind of gift? And you can do this. We were talking about this in pre-talk. You should really come sometime. It starts at 9 o'clock. It usually starts before I get there because I get there at 9:05 or something like that. But 9 o'clock is when it's supposed to start. And we have some very interesting conversations, and one of them was, we were talking about this question, is life a gift or not? And, maybe I'll hold off on some insights from other people till the end. But it's a worthwhile question. And you know, even if you have a very scientifically oriented post-enlightenment mind, that you did not create yourself, even if you don't like the word creation. And you have no say in things like oxygen or your breath. Well, now I'm already giving things away, but what Wayne was saying, breath is a gift. How do you know? Because when you're not, when you don't breathe, that's it. That's how we know. And you're not it, you're not, I'm the captain of my fate. You're completely dependent on oxygen. And the list goes on and on with this kind of question. So life is a gift, I think, is something that this time of year is supposed to remind us to be in conversation with. And every single spirituality and religion on the planet that I know of has some relationship with the question of, is life a gift or not? And the conclusion most of the time is, life is a gift, and therefore we'll orient ourselves to it in a certain way. Because you could ask the question, what's the opposite? How do you live if you do not think life is a gift? How does that manifest itself? Is that good for you? Is that good for other people? Is it good for the community? Is it good for your kids? Is it good for your grandkids? Is it good for the planet? Is it good for our, if it's, what then is the world if it's not a gift? And if you were living your life as if it was a gift, what would transform? Would it transform the way you listen to things like the news, like I was complaining about before? What would change? Or when you hear such polarizing debates and such nastiness and so forth and so on that you might also participate in, or I might participate in, what changes just with that single conversation? Is my life a gift or not? Is life a gift or not? Is life on the planet a kind of gift? And if I'm right, which I hope I'm not, but I am, that we're living in the last days, So what? And if life is a gift, and that changes my relationship with this thing I call life, doesn't matter what era I'm living in. How might that transform the conversation? Okay. Now I got a bunch of Bill Bryson quotes. I'll probably reread the one I read before, but here's the verse one. Not one of your pertinent ancestors, not one of your pertinent ancestors, not one of them was squashed, devoured, drowned, starved, stranded, stuck fast, untimely wounded, or otherwise deflected from its life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment in order to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly in you. This makes me want to give up writing, you know. That's okay, all right. It is so unlikely that you would be here. So astoundingly unlikely. I don't care if you think there's a creator or not. It's astoundingly unlikely that you're here. What the heck? And how far back does that chain go? One untimely accident with an axe one day, and you're not here. There were beings on this continent that were so dangerous that just to go outside and collect whatever was on the ground was a life-threatening exercise to get breakfast. So, I don't know. It's an idea. I know ideas, they don't always sink all the way in. You agree with what I'm saying, don't you? But, okay, if that were to sink in far enough, might it lead to a kind of question is, or a kind of feeling that maybe my life is a gift? Maybe I didn't manufacture myself. And astoundingly, I'm part of a chain of being, we could say, to use the old, medieval? Yeah, chain of being is a medieval idea. And I'm just one little link in the chain. That's it, you know? All right. I'll read the other Bill Bryson quote. Every atom you possess has almost certainly passed through several stars. That is ridiculous. Did I tell you about one time in the bottom of a pyramid I climbed into a tomb? You're not supposed to do this. Maybe I didn't tell you that. It's not a story I go around telling. So, this is in graduate school, and I was on a field study in Egypt, and the amazing thing about pyramids is that they're the opposite of what you think. You look at it, and everything is pointed up. Then as soon as you go into the pyramid, it takes you down, down into the underworld. And the Egyptians knew something about the underworld. And I went all the way down through the birth canal of the earth to the very bottom, and there was a single tomb, 6 or 7 feet high with a lid off, and an old Egyptian guard smoking a cigarette, and I thought to myself, I'm going to get in there. So I just waited for him to not look, and I climbed up in the tomb. Egyptian police don't mess around. I'm just going to give you a warning. So I had to be somewhat careful. And I laid down in this tomb exactly where Pharaoh had laid, or one of them. And I looked up at the ceiling for the first time, and it was painted in stars. That's all I'm going to say about it. Every atom you possess has almost certainly passed through several stars and been part of millions of organisms on its way to becoming you. We are each so atomically numerous and so vigorously recycled at death that a significant number of our atoms, up to 1 billion for each of us, it has been suggested, probably once belonged to Shakespeare. 1 billion more each came from Buddha and Genghis Khan and Beethoven and any other historical figure you care to name. So we are all reincarnations, though short-lived ones. When we die, our atoms will disassemble and move off to find new uses elsewhere. Aren't you happy about that? I mean, I am. As part of a leaf. That'd be nice to be a leaf, really. Or other human being or a drop of dew. Like what was in that poem, actually. He mentioned a kind of drop of something. I can't think of the line right now. Yeah, so life is a gift. Or as Jung says, it's a luminous pause between two great mysteries. All right, here's another Bill Bryson, then I'm done with him. The upshot of all this is that we live in a universe whose age we can't quite compute, surrounded by stars whose distances we don't altogether know, filled with matter we can't identify, operating in conformance with physical laws whose property we don't truly understand. See, that's Icarus crashing back down to the sea. I mean, human beings have done astounding things, but we still know almost nothing about even the most basic things of life. When we get to Mars, which personally I hope we don't, just personal opinion of mine, what then? How much will we really know then? Is that the key that will unlock what? And then they have to come back. If there even is a coming back. I know Elon Musk would disagree with me and blah, blah, blah. But part of human nature, I think, requires at least some humility. How did you get here? And what will happen to you when you're gone? Our wings are made of wax. Actually, that's not really what the myth says. The wings are wings. The joints are made of wax, which is more interesting in a way. Yes, we can fly, but the joints are made of wax. And every once in a while, we fly too high of the sun and we come back down. Yeah, so life is a gift. My friend Ryan, he's another big Ryan Meeks is his name, big megachurch pastor who also quit like me. Not that I'm praising that, I'm just saying. It's harder than you think. he says, he sort of left, I would say, left Christianity altogether. And he said, the only thing I know to say anymore is that life is a gift and love is the point. And, you know, sometimes little sayings like that, you know, like, well, all right, it's just a little saying, we could put it on a card, but there's something about it that is more profound to me. Life is a gift and love is a point. Love is the point. Life is a gift and love is the point. It's worth holding. It's worth holding. It doesn't matter what age or era or the fact that we're living in the end times, which we are. is actually the case. So, so I've got 3 points, and then I'm done. The first one I already made: life is a gift, and I'll add from him. Love is the point. But you can even disagree with that. That's a whole other talk. But life is a gift. What would it be just now, like this week? I mean, why not just try it? Here's my second point. What if we lived as if everything was alive and aware of our presence? It's true. What if we lived as if everything was alive and aware of our presence? There's a kind of awareness. Do you know trees are aware of other beings, including human ones? We know that's a scientific fact. Look it up. What if we lived as if everything was alive and aware of our presence? Sometimes when I lead wilderness programs, I'll ask people to go on wanders, because a big part of being outside is not sitting around talking. So I'll send people out on various wanders, and sometimes that's the only instruction. Walk as if everything were alive and aware of your presence, and what would happen to you if you walked that way? What would change? And believe it or not, you change the way you walk. It's like you become aware of awareness. And it starts to feel like maybe life is more of a gift than I thought. So, second suggestion. What if you lived as if everything were alive and aware of your presence? Here's my final point. What if we lived as if we were here to offer something? That's very old-fashioned, by the way. Very old-fashioned. What if we lived as if we were here to offer something in exchange for the gift of life? What if we lived as if we were here to offer something in exchange for the gift of life? Now, that's a very interesting idea. It has to do with gratitude. How many of you have ever received something that you felt like you didn't deserve? Well, you just took a breath, so there you have it. There's a kind of reciprocity that's possible with human consciousness. That's kind of amazing. And it feels like, at times, well, maybe then, if my life is a gift, what am I going to do with it? That's really the question. What if we lived as if we were here to offer something in exchange for the gift of life? That's kind of what parenthood is like, now that I think about it. The old word for that is sacrifice. I know that's kind of an old word, and people don't love that word, unless they're strange like me. But sacrifice actually technically means to make sacred. That's all it means, to make sacred. And it's possible to make your life sacred. That's my way of putting it. It's possible to live that way. As if we have something to offer in exchange for the gift of life. Now, easier said than done, and the world is complex, but I think I'll leave you with that. One more time from Bryson, and I'm done. Not one of your pertinent ancestors was squashed, devoured, drowned, starved, stranded, stuck fast, untimely wounded, or otherwise deflected from its life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment in order to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly, in you.